Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
That's true fact.
Justin Robert Young.
Oh, hi, friends.
And Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody.
I just muted myself to adjust my microphone. Hey, listen, folks. I don't need to get into the technical details of how this podcast comes together. It's really complicated. It just involves atoms and molecules and stuff. You know, there's a little interesting article in the news today.
Yes. I think I know what you're talking about, and I'm very excited to get here. This is one of the longest running threads on Weird Things, if it's what I think you're going to talk about.
You're talking about the third one on the list here.
Okay. All right. Oh, wow. Even more news. So that's a tease, ladies and gentlemen.
So yeah. Snakes, spiders, and space elevators.
Yep. One of the above. So researchers have been doing some very interesting work in growing clumps of brains in dishes. And now they're able to grow like parts of primate brains. Now understand, this isn't like a full-on brain, but it's not just like a bunch of little brain cells. We're like, hey, what do we do? These things are kind of organized into structures. These neurons communicate with each other. You can actually, like in some cases, there's been reports of where they can give them signals and they give signal responses. At what point does this become creepy?
I mean, already way past that, man. The moment you took that off ramp.
Well, look, is it creepy now? Yes. But these kinds of conversations, I think, are always about where our frame of reference is. You know, a wise man. I remember a wise man once telling me when I was but a youth that at some point you can imagine that people were horrified that there were whole banks filled with human blood. And now it is understood to be a noble, important, life-giving resource within where we have charity drives so people will donate it. And it isn't looked at as some bizarre genetic hoarding, but rather a good tenant of health and prosperity. Similarly, I think that that's where we're going with this kind of research, specifically considering like the brain seems like the key to unlocking so much of not only our prosperity, but also possible immortality.
Well, and plus also, I guess, you know, as we've talked, when we put on our futurist hats, oftentimes some crazy technologies at first make perfect sense to cure diseases. So in this case, like, yeah, we should know how to grow primate brains so that we can repair our damaged primate brains to people who have, you know, injuries or so on. But then it's like, well, why stop it just making us whole? Why not just crank it up to 11? Let's get a little extra juice out of these noggins. And then at what point, like, you just keep on growing more and more brains till we look like Mars Attacks?
Well, how about let's just go back to the brain in the jar thing. At what point? So now what happens when they're like, yeah, we can make a whole brain. We're gonna put a whole brain in here. We're gonna put a whole brain inside of here, and test it and measure it. Human brain. We cool?
I mean, if we grow a human brain, but we don't know what it's thinking or...
We know we can give some stimulus, the Thanksgiving responses. We can trigger things like scent and smell and whatnot. And it's, you know, giving... It's alive.
Man, no, that's an interesting moral conundrum, because if we have that ability to build a genetic... I mean, at that point, it wouldn't even be a simulacrum. It would be an actual brain, but a brain without a body and theoretically with consciousness and yet no stimulation, thought without direction or input sounds horrifying to me. But I guess that happens to people who are, you know, with locked-in syndrome and so on.
Well, but also it seems clear that it is only through that barrier that we have a greater understanding and enhancement of everybody's life, right? Like, you know, if we are creating this aimless thought for the purpose of understanding it, then yes, we have responsibility. And yes, it is. I mean, I guess to Andrew's point, yes, it is indeed creepy. It is indeed something that we will look at and say, this is very, very creepy. I can't believe that we're doing this, much in the same way that we look at animal testing in a way that we're like, oh, well, that seems cruel to do to animals. It is justified by what we get out of it. And if we get out of it a greater understanding of our own brain, then our societal line for how creepy it is will decrease.
I love the idea that there's a whole lab of people and just there's somebody they keep on saying like, oh my God, I can't believe we're doing this. Oh, it's so creepy. Oh, it's so freaky. We're making a brain. Oh, I can't believe it.
And then like a week later, keep like, going. Oh, remember when we did that? Now we're making the bigger one. Oh, it's gross.
Yeah.
Okay. You've made the argument, Justin, like, well, if it's for human advancement, I'm okay with, as you said, testing on humans who have no ability to give consent. It just happened to be brains. Understood. It's a summation of your argument, right?
All right, 700 Club. Fine, go ahead.
And we're always looking at the noble things, but what if it's some like, wow, we're working on this boner drug. We just want to make sure that it doesn't cause hallucinations, you know? So what if it's for, I mean, I think that, you know, and this is an area that ethicists, bioethicists talk about, you know, extensively. There are entire conferences that deal with this stuff. There's a whole literature out there about this. But it's a thing to think about is say, okay, we're okay with this. We're okay with these clusters. At what point do we go, whoa? And there are limits that scientists sort of, I think, they agree upon. Like, let's not like go full neocortex. Let's not give this thing sentience, whatever. But it's.
Now, that's interesting. If they could just do the parts of the brain, like, you know, just a limbic system or whatever, and then test on it, especially if you're, you know, building things to repair it, that seems totally ethical. And we've already talked before about the idea, as creepy as it sounds, like I'm on board with growing a clone of a body without a head, just, you know, for backup organs, because there's no consciousness or in there. Man, that is a hoo boy.
Yeah. These are questions. I don't have a strong opinion.
So how much primate brains were they able to grow?
They called organoids. They're able to grow, you know, some human brains to an extent. And if we look at, you know, I have not seen, there are some interesting sort of like images that show the growth of these things. I'm not quite sure how much, but these things have been arranging themselves into 3D structures. You know, and these things are, these are brain cells and stuff like neurons that we have, but this is nowhere near a brain right now, like a human brain. There's a whole structure, there's an organizational thing, there's a lot more that goes into it. But, and it's extremely useful for figuring out how things like, you know, Alzheimer's and other sorts of diseases and things work. But you can see the structure, we're looking at an image right here of what they call an organoid.
Yeah.
The complexity there.
Yeah. I mean, I hate to put it in simple terms, but you're right. It's creepy. You're right. It's scary. Implications down the road or whatever. But all of that is so quickly trumped at this moment by our desperate need to know more about the diseases and have tools to be able to correct those diseases.
Yeah. And that's my larger point is we have a way of justifying things if they immediately benefit us. Like, you know, if you walked into your neighbor's house and he had a gigantic fish tank full of blood, you'd be like, I need to call the police. But if they do it at a hospital or some kind of a clean facility, and now all of a sudden your accident is survivable because they have your type on hand, then you're like, oh my God, thank God this thing is here. So there's always a line in which the benefit will outweigh the means to a certain point. And look, there's a reason why we have entire conferences in the bioethics of it and exactly how far we should push and if they're the right way to do it. Because obviously you can cross the line and thankfully we should be talking about it.
Question was asked in our chat section here. Could this techniques like this be used for helping functions for paraplegics and quadriplegics? That's, you know, those are some of the potential areas of research that, you know, this applies to. It's one of the, you know, can, you know, if you can influence, you know, neurons to grow and you can regrow these structures and not just one-offs, whatever. And like here, looking at 3D structures, et cetera, like, yeah, that's one of the potential areas for this. So there's a lot of them, you know, that, you know, talk into it. We have, or one of our commenters here knows way more about this topic than we do. So yeah, it's always
Tally Zarel, who is one of our favorite Diamond Club commenters, actually does work on neurosurgery or neuroexperimentation, not neurosurgery, neuroexperimentation out in Canada. But she is constantly toying with mouse brains and, learning what we have to be learned.
Yeah, she points out we can differentiate neurostem cells, but not have them develop into neuroblastoma, which is what you don't want to happen where things go out of control. And that's the beautiful thing about petri dishes, things like this, to contain environments. But yeah, that's the problem, is that you can get things to grow, but how do you regulate this growth and how do you control it? So, yeah. Hey, I got a cool hack for you.
Oh, right. What's on.
What's the craziest cool hack you've ever heard of? I've got the best one ever. I mean, I'll let you guys try.
Are you talking about like a
computer, like, computing, like
computer, you know, hack,
exploit hack?
Not like a life hack where you put a dustbin on top of a 2-liter and it makes you pour things into the 2-liter easy or something like that. Like
you
said, you
add your own diet of Crystal Pepsi, make it whatever color you want.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, like those awesome life hacks. I feel like those have gone away. That might be a little bit dated. I don't know if they're still going on the life hack revolution.
Peak life hack for me was, it was actually the same one that was peak life hack for Merlin Mann. Was Lifehacker had was literally like use dish cleaning detergent in your dishwasher for cleaner dishes. I remember reading this. I'm like, well, we've run to the end of this, and I saw Marilyn Mailer post a tweet like, I'm like, yeah, like that was just
that's amazing.
He reached the end of the internet.
Coolest, no. Like computer code hack, like computer exploit hack.
Well, I mean, I know the one that's making the news is that whole spying on other people by joining a group chat conversation and FaceTiming, getting 15 seconds of other people's times. That's a pretty good bug, I would imagine.
Yeah, so that was a bug in group FaceTime where you were able to hear the microphone before somebody picked up. But that's not like a proper hack, you know, like I think that would be more the terrain of a podcast that Brian turned me onto, the Darknet Diaries kind of hacks that have become kind of infamous or interesting.
Well, I've got one for you here.
Go ahead. There are a couple, and I do want to shout out Darknet Diaries because I do enjoy it. But the one that they recently talked about, which I thought was pretty interesting and had some fairly cool implications, is one where a guy realized, and this was not, didn't take a ton of great code, but basically figured out a way to use open printer ports to have tens of thousands of printers all print out your settings are insecure and subscribe to PewDiePie. Subscribe from T-Series. But it was a great interview. But all right, but that apparently not even making the not even entering the arena when it comes to Andrew's 10,000 pound gorilla, top number one hack of all time.
It strikes all the right things for me. It's technology, bioscience, aliens, everything.
Oh, wait, is it when Jeff Goldblum hacked the aliens at the end of Independence Day?
It's close.
Oh my God.
This was some researchers from University of Washington. This is the claim here. They presented an exploit where they were able to put code, and this is Tadayoshi Kono, they were able to put malicious code, you know, to be able to, like, take over a computer into a strand of DNA.
Oh,
that then
shoot.
Was read by a sequencer, and it was able to exploit the sequencer because they found a bug in the way the sequencer would process the DNA and theoretically take control of a DNA sequencer.
Yeah, that's some. Now, I did see this headline go past and I skimmed it. I guess this was a very specific case where it's like, they engineered it for this specific machine because they knew there was this code. But as a proof of concept, that's astonishing, man.
Yeah. I mean, that's the equivalent of that would be, you know, figuring out like you know, there was, that was like, you know, an image that could hack a visual recognition system. You know, look at this image, which I think it's been something that's been used. I think Neal Stephenson used that as like a plot point or something like that. But that's kind of a creepy, you know, creepy idea.
Yeah, that's insanely creepy. Like, I mean, as if we need to worry more about, you know, the new front of worrying about technology, which we have done since the advent of the earliest, most crude forms of technology. The idea that there is something that can replicate within us that would be directed by somebody else is insane. That's crazy.
Or just the idea that, you know, that's a thought that's been, you know, addressed before. I talked to some researchers a while ago who are looking to see, like, could they find in junk DNA, which it's very, in a, you know, not quite accurate term, but they were looking for signs of kinds of encoding, like did DNA have its own way of chewing compression and stuff. But the other thing that's to talk about is, like, could there be, you know, did, instead of looking for signals with SETI, did aliens just, you know, put some patterns inside of our DNA that isn't even there, then when they like they show up, like, yeah, no, we visited you like 500 million years ago.
Oh, essentially taking one of our early species or whatever and doing the equivalent of putting an ear tag on us, where it's just like, just in case somebody else comes along, we already know them, they're fine. Eventually, they'll be growing their own brains in petri dishes.
What if they show up and they're like, hey, we got a cure for cancer. It's not cheap. We got a cure for cancer. I'm like, wait, how do you have a cure for cancer?
it's called the undo button in our previous work.
It's like, oh, geez.
Wow, that would be hilarious if all of a sudden, like, that's our first contact to alien life, is the fact that some intergalactic federation has officially unlocked advertising rights for Earth,
or essentially they've ransomwared our whole planet's population, and they're like, do you guys have a Galacticoin? We're gonna need six bazillioids of it.
Well, I'm gonna go a little conspiracy future conspiracy theory, and it's not something we believe now, but like, man, like, looking at like these Bitcoin ransom heists, what we just talked about, the DNA thing, imagine somebody engineering a version of the flu. If there's a cure and it costs you 1,000 bitcoins each to get it,
man. And what if here's the really sinister thing is,
oh, that's not sinister.
Well, no. The sinister thing would be, it's not even fatal. It's just like a bummer. Man. It's like, hey man, look, you got an option. You could take a week off of work and get very little done, or you can get back to work immediately. If you just give us 1,000.
Wow. I mean, you know, I guess we have like the proto versions of that in Vegas with those, you know, hook you up to an IV bag clinics, right? Like they're selling you on both sides of it. They're like, hey, get drunk in the desert. And then when you wake up with a splitting headache, they're like, hey, we'll hook a bag of water up to your arm.
Yeah. But I mean, I think the idea of engineering something like,
oh,
that, you know, right now you have this thing where companies that have unsecure networks find out, like, oh, all of your data has been encrypted, like hospital records and stuff. It's been encrypted. Yeah. Pay us Bitcoin and we'll unencrypt it for you, you know. So,
no, that would be like, what level? All right. So let's say that happens. Who goes after them? Like, under what jurisdiction is the biohacker who's ransoming people $1,000 to you know, just
it would be FBI, but you would have, you know, with an assist from the CDC, things like this. You're looking for things when you get, like, you know, anthrax scares or stuff like that, you know.
Yeah, involved, but this would be on a level, I mean, like, that would be,
well, it's bioterrorism, so it could be DHS. I mean, it's a lot of things, so
yeah. So I mean, that would be like, that would fall under on a lot of people's plates, right? Like, that would be crazy.
Yeah. Excuse me, guys, I gotta go write a book. You know what? I won't, because I'm gonna stay here due to the support of everybody here, all of our fans on Patreon.
Absolutely. Patreon.com/weirdthings, where you can support this show. Head on over there right now and give us whatever you got, man. This is a fun little place in which we talk about all sorts of things. We bring you science news. We bring you musings of the odd. We bring you stories about snakes and spiders. We reward long-term listening like we will right after this Patreon plug because we love you so. And if you love us back, then head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings.
All right. Let's go to the story that was teased at the beginning. And I come here to praise Caesar, okay? there was an idea that was started several years ago, and I think we all had enthusiasm for part of the idea. I had a big issue with the mission because I thought it was very fatalistic and not really looking at where we are and also just the Enterprise set about to accomplish this. We're talking about Mars One. Mars One was the group that several years ago came out and said, hey, we're gonna fund our own mission to Mars. It's going to be one way. We're gonna raise money through one, having people, you know, join Mars One and pay the entrance fees and do this. And then what we're gonna do is we're gonna basically gonna send 100 people to live on Mars, and we're gonna pay for the rest of this through, you know, reality television. As a producer of this stuff, I thought comical. But they wanted to do this because their goal is let's go to Mars. But their plan was to send a group of people to Mars and leave them there, but then make them dependent upon extremely expensive resupply missions or just, you know, watch them and die. I had problems with that approach.
Yeah. What was our initial, our initial thoughts on this were, A, on its very, 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 very base level, we like the idea of more people putting money into exploring space and Mars specifically. I think Andrew laid out some of the issues in terms of the specifics of it. But if I remember correctly, the first big question was almost as much about whether or not it was ethical to send one-way missions to Mars.
And that was a discussion we were having. Part of the reason we were so infatuated with Mars One is because before Mars One was announced, we were having that question, and we I think I talked about that Radiolab idea of sending somebody one way to Mars, and the schism, if I as best I remember, is I was a fan of them trying. And I knew that Mars One was doomed and was never going to work to begin with, but I like people trying crazy, stupid things. And Andrew seemed like the distorted memories I have is Andrew's just like stop trying to punch the sun. You can't do it. You know,
no.
It was so ludicrous that you were not a fan of it from the beginning.
My problem was, one, it was a grift. It was hey, sign up, pay us this. We're going to try to go do this. Their plan was idiotic. They didn't bring in people to go in and say, is this a viable plan? So they went out and they fundraised with a dumb – that was my problem. They didn't bring in experts on this to say, is this feasible? And I'm like, I can only cheer people poking themselves in the eye so much. I'm all for citizen space stuff. If somebody wanted to do, hey, we're going to do Mars 3, and our plan is we want to subsidize, their plan was, oh, how are you going to get there? We're going to hire SpaceX. Okay. If somebody had said back then, we want to go to Mars, our goal is we're going to try to build a sustainable colony there. We know it's early stages, but we want to do this. We're not going to grift people for membership subscriptions and stuff and tell people they've been selected and given these false hopes and false dreams like this. There were so many things they could have done differently that'd be fine. I think we need a citizens organization that wants to go there and wants to colonize. I want that. I didn't want to sue a citizens death cult that wanted to send people to die there. That was my problem, because that was effectively what was going to, you know, had they ever managed to, their plan was, oh, we'll go there. And then to me, it was the go for Mar. I'm wearing my Martian T-shirt
for audio listeners. Yeah, Andrew's holding his Martian T-shirt.
So my problem was it sucks the air out of the room for other stuff, because SpaceX dealt with the problem for several years. And again, Mars One has a right to do whatever they want as long as they're within the law. No problem with that. But I would encounter so many people like, oh, is SpaceX, aren't they the ones that want to, you know, send people to Mars to never come back or whatever? And it's like, you know, that was my problem. I'm like, I see this headache coming.
Well, let's also get the news peg out of the way. Mars One has declared bankruptcy or had bankruptcy declared upon it. I couldn't quite make
the for-profit side of it, and that was part of the issue. There's a for-profit side of it. Yeah, apparently has declared bankruptcy. The nonprofit exists, but it's not funded.
Okay. So I think it breaks into two issues, one of which is something that we can debate, and the other, I think, is a little clearer. And let's start with the grift part, because that, to me, is where most serious conversation about Mars One specifically kind of ends. If the three of us were to say, we're going to make a phone better than the iPhone, and we're going to do it within 5 years, and everybody needs to pay us the $800 to make it, and we will deliver sometime within the next 5 to 8 years, that would probably be a grift. Like, because there's reasonably, we can probably make a phone, but it's not going to be a phone as good as the iPhone. We have very little infrastructure. We have very little planning. We're just three guys on a podcast. So it is taking an idea that is feasible, and it is exploiting it for money now without any reasonable pathway to we make a phone in 6 to 8 years.
I don't think legally that would make it a grift. Legally, this is the subject of the whole movie Tucker, A Man in His Dream, is the difference is whether or not we believed we could do it and whether or not in good faith we tried. I mean, business all the time, like whether we can or can't, if we try, then it's not a grift.
Okay. Then maybe grift. I don't want to get bogged down on whether or not it's illegal, right? But I do think that it is, whether or not we believe that we can, if something is transparently foolhardy, I do think that you are owed, like, at the very least, we could be looked at by those around us and say, you are leading people off a cliff. And if I don't have an answer for why that cliff isn't coming, then I do think that that should reflect poorly on our reputations.
Sure.
Yeah. The grift part I bring up came from the claims that they were selling like memberships, or you could get in there and you could, you'll get into the special astronaut group or whatever. Claims that was where people were being told, oh yeah, no, like if you pay more, then we're going to, you know, you're going to be in the next tier or whatever. Claims of that approach, I don't want to disparage, but that's where a big part of it came from. Like, yeah, I think that they were sincere. I don't doubt that when they started this, they thought it was a realistic idea, but they went out of their way to avoid, you know, talking to people who could say, well, here's a more realistic thing. Here are the issues. You know, I ran into this when I worked for the James Rand Educational Foundation. You know, we get people in there who have these, you know, quack cures and stuff like that. And that's very different than Mars. I mean, that's maybe not compare the Mars One people to people who are like, you know, going to kill you with something that doesn't work. But with these quack remedies, most people believe they worked. And then you'd say, well, how about if you do this test or whatever? They're like, meh, you know, what about this sort of approach? Meh. And that was the thing. It's like, I think they were sincere, but they also sort of avoided, you know, a lot of the due diligence, because, you know, sending people to Mars is serious.
Yeah, sure. Well, so, and if I was going to give my most charitable defense in the abstract, because I agree, if they were running a scheme, and it does seem like they had a whole bunch of structures, and I wouldn't be surprised if it came out that internally a bunch of people are like, yeah, we're never going to make it to Mars, but we got to get them dollars in here before we implode. You know, obviously all that is terrible, but there are precedents to when you're at the cusp of a technological revolution and something is about to exponentially become more affordable, all of a sudden outrageous business plans become at least within the realm of possibility. One example is Microsoft continuously for decades was writing software that no computer could run because they knew that 18 months from now, okay, some will be able to, and another 18 months after that, all of them will be able to. And so likewise, if I'm being as charitable as possible, I could see Mars One believing that we're on the cusp of that type of thing. And then even the idea of, you called it a death cult. I don't think, and again, this is me putting on the most charitable interpretation, it was any more a death cult than the idea of a pioneer going to Oregon was, you know, you're going to go to Oregon? When are you going to come back? You're like, no, I plan to die in Oregon. Die in Oregon? What? What is this death cult? And so the idea being that if they were, if they believed that they were on the cusp of all of a sudden it becoming more and more affordable to send more and more stuff, then it gets less and less crazy to imagine just moving to Mars and then just building out the cities. You know, you become pioneers, and that seems less crazy.
Like, they would be like pioneers. Say, we're going to go to move to the middle of the Mojave Desert, and we think people will keep sending us food and water. And that was my approach. That's different for me because, like, you know, Oregon. Right,
but didn't
guess
that...
what? Native Americans were surviving there for years. This was, you know, the SpaceX proposal is the idea of let's lower the cost. So we can continuously send rockets every 2 years, and let's build an infrastructure for doing that. And if we send people there, we're sure as hell going to have a plan to bring them back. That was my problem with this was it was this unintentionally suicidal.
let me ask you guys this.
Okay.
Let me ask you this. So same business plan, same reality television element, same membership thing. But it doesn't happen however many years ago. It happens today. And tag on the CEO has like up on his Instagram just a picture of like him and Elon Musk at a party, like just kind of arm in arm. Therefore, just not even an official thing, not an official notice, not an official press release, but just some kind of indication that considering how much farther we are on the timeline now, how much more of a reality SpaceX is as a rocket company now than they were even 5 years ago. That now the idea of within 7 to 8 years, it's not quite as far-fetched. Does it change in any way, Andrew?
Wait, just saying the Mars One people?
Mars One, yeah.
I don't think they got one. When you had people who were finalists who are coming out saying that, you know, like calling it a scam, saying that like, yeah, they asked for money from our appearances and stuff like this, all of that, that they ignored the most optimistic advice from aerospace people. I'm not talking about the optimistic things. Why would I have confidence in them now?
I'm saying that the first one didn't happen. Like now Mars One never announced 5 years ago. They're announcing today.
Well, it's you would ask the same questions you would ask. You know, we ask, you know, SpaceX talks about, you know, hey, we want to build colonies. You're like, okay, what are the technical details? How are you going to solve these problems? Why should we give our money to you as opposed to some other organization that maybe has scientists working on it and engineers?
So now it might even be more perilous because now there is real money in this, and you're like, well, wait, hold on. Like, if you want to be building colonies, like, there are other people that are further along.
I think there are groups like the L5 Society and other ones which do want to do people in space. I think are really cool, and they're maybe a little cultish, whatever, things like this, but they're braced in the science on this. If an organization started tomorrow that was like, hey, we got some scientists, engineers, we have a viable plan, I'll write a donation. I'm sure, you know.
All right, everybody.
I got excited when I heard about Mars One initially. I'm like, oh, cool. And then I read there. I'm like, oh, my God, this is horrible.
Brian, do you have any different feelings if they announce today?
I am convinced that whatever some version of essentially the same idea is going to happen. And it's not even a question of if, it's just a question of when. So, you know, to dance on the grave of Mars One is not to say, haha, told you it was a bad idea. It's to say, too early, boys, too early, and you didn't get the right experts.
Well, I mean, I don't think colonizing Mars is a bad idea. My issue is the half-assery approach. Like, I'd say, let's start our own right now. Let's start our own colonize our Mars exploration organization. I'm all for it. Let's do it.
All right. What are we calling it?
Mars 2.
Mars 2. The T-O-O. 2.
Look who's Marsing now.
I'm serious. Like, I think – I've said, hey, not here to bury Caesar or to praise him. Like, I'm a supporter of the Planetary Society. I like these things. I legit want us to have an organization that's excited about Mars and doing cool Mars things. I want that. Yeah. That was not what this.
Well, and I think that of all the arguments to be happy that Mars One is out of the picture, I think the strongest is because they were sucking the air out of the room for organizations and plans that had a much better chance of you know actually doing something. So it's like it's a bummer if a bunch of people have already looked at Mars One, came up with the idea like, oh yeah, going to Mars and staying there equals scam, and then that creates a problem when Elon Musk says, "Hey, I'm gonna go to Mars and stay there."
Yeah, I tend to think that part of it is just Mars One was a bit of an exploitation of excitement versus reality, and using that as a launching pad. And while I totally agree with you, Brian, that it's like. Yeah, you want to know what? You might have been first in the door, and so you get shot first. There is, like, you look at them, and it's like, well, I don't know. It's kind of seemed, you know, like they just had a much more relevant coat of paint on Magic Beans than maybe somebody who was legitimately trying to do what they said they were trying to do.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree with that.
Gentlemen, you want any picks?
Yeah, boy. I got a pick.
Yeah.
Hey, there's this service called Netflix.
tell me more.
I watched a thing on Netflix because I only watched the thing that people watched the week before on Netflix. I finished Sex Education. I thought it was charming and fun. And then I watched the first episode of Russian Doll, which I really liked. I have no idea. What is it? 8 episodes?
10? Yeah. 10?
8 or 10. I think. Yeah. So 8. It's 8.
I have no idea how it's going to stretch out to that many episodes based on the first episode. But I'm excited to see it because people seem to not hate it. So I am enchanted by the premise of it stretching out to 8 episodes.
Hmm. Yeah. I don't think it's a spoiler to say, like, I too had that fear, and just as I was afraid that it was going to dip, and then I'm like, oh, wait, well, no, this is interesting now. And then they were able to keep me all the way to the end.
They do a thing in the middle of that series that makes you think, oh, this is, they're going, like, they do a thing in the middle of the series where you think, okay, so this is how they're going to do this show forever and ever and ever and ever, and it seems awful, but it's not. It's just enough to get you to the end, I think. Because I had a very similar thing of like, I don't know how much we have left in this tank.
What,
because this
but I think that this is what I love about that premise, about that Groundhog Day premise, is that you can go a lot of places with it. And you can either delve into the why, or you can make it about everything else and then make the why magical. There's a lot of things you can do. So it's just a matter of like, it is just like a very audacious premise to start with, because you are basically daring the audience to say, watch how I fill in this blank page, which is interesting and cool.
You know, I think that, I haven't seen it, but I'll tell you something that used that premise, and then you're 30 minutes into it and you're like, I get it. And then they change it up enough that you go, oh, it was, and I can never remember the name, is Edge of Tomorrow.
Yes. I always call it The Day After Tomorrow, which is another movie entirely that's not good. But Edge of Tomorrow to me was one of those movies where I was like, this is awesome. And it gets into the why, and it does some other really cool stuff with that genre that I had not seen before, which was a super, super fun. But a big, big shout out to Edge of Tomorrow.
Yeah, agreed.
That was just as quick side. That was a movie that the marketing department, I think, really did damage, because they were worried about the name and they promoted it, but you saw the put was like the day after today or whatever, that it to this day, like, you see Edge of, yeah, you look like, you see Live, Die, Repeat is big. They had other phrases were big in the posters that, like, every time I go, like, well, I know the original novel is called All You Need Is Kill, and I'm always going, like, what was it called?
That's the thing, is that it swam through, because none of those names are good. Like,
they gaslighted us.
Yeah, they've never, because like all you need is kill. I have no idea what the hell's going on. Edge of Tomorrow, I have no idea what's going on.
Edge of Tomorrow, I'm actually going to defend that title because it preserves the surprise at the end of the first act. I think they desperately wanted, they're like, look, man, if we could just promote this as Tom Cruise sci-fi, maybe you're thinking, Minority Report kind of Tom Cruise stuff. And if you show up, like, it was so fun watching that movie with Josie, and she didn't know what the conceit was. And it was like, at the end of the first act, her mind is already blown and she's all in. And Edge of Tomorrow is close enough to Live, Die, Repeat, where it's like you never quite get to tomorrow. You keep reliving the same day or whatever. That if it had landed, man, I think it would have been precious. But instead, it underperformed at launch. And so when they released the DVD, they pretty much changed the name to Live, Die, Repeat, which is, yeah, again, you know, from an artistic perspective, you know, the question is, how much do you give up? You know, do you protect the surprise
disagree, Brian, and I think that it should have gone with my suggestion, which is Groundhog Day or Starship Troopers. I don't know. How about both in the same movie starring Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt?
My problem is that I've been gaslighted into not knowing what the title of it is. Like, I literally don't know. Like, I cannot remember the name of this movie because they changed the titles, and there was some production. It's been like, fine, production doesn't count, but like twice. And I'm like, what is that movie? It's like some, you know, Jedi technique of like, remember this title? No, we're going to give the Mandela effect to everybody. That's not what the movie was you saw.
Yeah. Go check it out though. It's rad.
But I agree. I like Edge of Tomorrow's title. Either title's fine. I just want to know. I want certainty in my world.
Hey, did any of you guys see Swiss Army Man?
No.
Not sure how I felt about it. My pick is that you watch it and tell me what you think of it. And by you, I mean everybody. There are parts and ideas that I liked a lot. And then the ending, I was like, oh, all right.
Can you give us a little bit of
I
can see that?
The stuff that they showed in the preview is a dude is stranded and alone, and a corpse washes up, but the corpse is like amazingly useful in really base and weird ways. Like he farts so fast that he can ride him like a jet ski. He uses his teeth to bite and sever ropes, and he shoves acorns in him and then twists his arm and he coughs and spits them out like bullets, and it's really absurdist, and I like the absurdist parts, and I like visually they create some really interesting set pieces. And of course, as you're watching all of this, you're like, well, is this guy going crazy? Is this really happening? It's so insane, over the top. You know, does he make it back home or whatever? Then the ending, if you ever get around to watching it, just tell me what you thought of the ending.
It was certainly a movie that was fun to hear about.
Yeah.
Because every time the absurdity kept getting, you know, amped up more and more.
Yeah. And they do. And again, I mean, there's like seven or eight, like, oh, that's a funny, that's yet another biological function that I guess could be weaponized or made into a useful thing. Yeah, I don't know. A cautious, reserved pick for Swiss Army Man. It was fun to play Hearthstone while watching.
I've got a pick. Over the past week, I have been in anticipation of season 3, catching up on season 2 of The Handmaid's Tale. And
oh man, a joyful rock and roll.
I will say, season 2 is certainly less graphic than season 1. Not that it's not graphic, but it is certainly less. But I also think that it tries to, that the end of season 1 has a very like deliberate like direction where you're like, okay, this is the start of a thing that is just a pretty well-known trope. And then season 2, like the first few episodes of season 2, really change it to be more of a character-driven thing. And so season two is a little different. But I have to say, like, overall, I'm enjoying it. And the drama and the tension are really solid. There's a really great episode in season two. I want to say it's episode 10 or 11, where I won't even talk about the details of it. But it is a very, like, super tense, super suspenseful moment that feels totally earned. And
is it the one in the country home?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I guess that entire set piece, where it's all very well earned, and because it's a very quiet sort of, it's a very fits and spurts in terms of energy sort of show. When you have just that extended, emotional and dramatic moment, I was definitely like super tensing up along with the character. It's really solid. So I think if you liked season one, really give season two a try. And it sounds like season three is on the way soon, but they didn't even have a date on the Super Bowl commercial. So.
They actually just had a date today. So somebody can find that. I had mixed feelings about season one. I very much enjoyed season two's early commitment to its world building, because I think that is, to me, the most interesting part of that premise is what this nation is, what Gilead is, how Gilead became Gilead, and how Gilead functions.
And how it fits internationally. You see different
That's bits that are... And unfortunately, I kind of felt like it. I don't know if it's thought as much about Gilead as I want it to think about Gilead. And the one thing I can't say about season two is, man, if you like creepy rituals, you are pretty much guaranteed like one creepy ritual an episode, and that I'm all here for. Yeah. I love myself some creepy rituals from Gilead. Other than that, I was made furious by how they ended the second season, to the point where I don't really want to watch the third.
Oh, okay. So I haven't watched the last episode yet. So I guess I'll text you when I finish.
I think when the show gets beyond its self, well, I mean, I don't know. There's some like kind of societal elements. Obviously, yeah. it does not shy away from being a commentary on culture and politics, right? Mm. And I think that when it gets, I don't find that the most interesting part of it.
Yeah.
And I think that it is there as a performative element at times that subtracts from the fact that at its core, it could be a really rad, like, you know, a post-apocalyptic sort of like science fiction thing. But you have to tell us the story of why it's there. That's what's fascinating about it. Here's what I'll say. There is a point toward the end of the season when I heard more people talk about a briefly shown map of Gilead than where any of the characters ended up by the end of the end of the season. And that, I feel, is indicative of the fact that we got a brief second and everybody wanted to talk about where things are on the map, and no conversation about where these characters ended up. And that frustrated me a lot.
Lost statue, four-toed statue.
Yeah. And it's like, look, yeah, when you see the four-toed statue, you're like, man, I'm pumped to see how we can weave all this in. They're throwing a lot of balls in the air, and yet it's more about how Sawyer's a really lonely guy, and one day he'll find love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
June 5th. Just found out. June 5th, season 3. So.
Or is it Offred 5th?
Do you think that's intentional? Do you think that's they're going to do that in the marketing? Make a trailer that says Offred 5th?
I don't think subtlety is a real strength of that show or the marketing behind it. So probably.
Yeah.
My pick is, let's watch this again. Galaxy Quest.
Oh, man. Oh. So good. So good.
Grabthar's hammer.
What, yeah. Wasn't there? I thought we had talked about a TV series in the works. I don't know if it was a Netflix thing or what, but, man, it's great.
There had been talk. Periodically there had been talk about doing it. And then, you know, when Alan Rickman died, you know, a lot of the enthusiasm for that went away. Then there was talk again. And gosh, I forget, a comedian writer. He was at somebody was a, like Paul Scheer, I think it was like attached to like bring it back. And then it sort of, you know, didn't happen. And then there was talk about doing it kind of like the new generation of cast or whatever. So, you know, it's one of these things that it would be delightful, but you know, with the loss of Alan Rickman, it's kind of like, I'm often like, hey, bring everything back that we want it back or whatever. But so much of that, you know, just the dynamic, you know, with him, it's just,
oh God, it's just so good. And so perfect. And that cast, I mean, a cast at just the right time for everybody.
I wonder what the original R-rated version would have looked like, because there are some moments like they developed it to be an R-rated thing. And there's a couple of moments that really stand out where she needs to jump through some gnashing gate or whatever and says, screw that. And her lips are not saying screw that. Yeah. And then, and likewise, they really only imply that the transporter guy Monk is high all the time. In fact, it the first time I saw it, I was like, he's acting weird like a villain or whatever, and I didn't get it. And then only after I found out, like, oh, this is originally gonna be rated R, I bet they explicitly made it clear he was just baked all the time. But now it's like, instead, yeah, he just kind of acts weird.
History. Bring me an oral history of Galaxy Quest. How has this not happened? I'm challenging the ringer.com. Get me the oral history of Galaxy Quest. Post haste.
Yeah. So, there's one line in there where Sam Rockwell's character said, like, are you high or whatever? And that's, you know, I think the extent of our, you know, the reference. But then you look at like, oh yeah, he's like a stoner.
Yeah.
You know.
Like, yeah, and that's why he's fallen in love with this television show, because he gets high and watches Galaxy Quest.
Wait, no, he was on.
No, on he was show. On it. He was.
Oh, yeah. Oh no. Yeah. Oh, sorry. I thought it meant the. Okay, yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah. So yeah, there's been not a lot of, I don't think there's been any talk in like a year or so over a revival of it. So, yeah.
You know, what's wild is I don't know that my kids would get anything about it, you know, and maybe they're familiar with the tropes just by osmosis from culture, but they never watched much Star Trek.
I think the idea of the people that did the thing being recognized by aliens, I mean, like science, it's not like science fiction and space adventure has gone away. If anything, there are more people that are past their prime and have a tortured relationship with their early career that,
ooh, boy, yeah,
you know, would be pulled out of it. Like, you know, I think that idea, I mean, geez, think of it like that. Think of where fan conventions were at the point that Galaxy Quest comes out compared to where fan conventions are now.
Oh, yeah.
Like that whole idea, like imagine any con anywhere in America. Now that cast is transported to the world that they were operated in fantasy.
You know, and I wonder how much of the joke at the time was perceived as, you know, making fun of those conventions before those conventions became, you know, the new norm.
Well, you know, the SNL skit that probably inspired it.
Yeah, the one where there. The dude is wearing a shirt that says, I grok Spock, and William Shatner just tears off into them.
Move out of your parents' basement.
Yeah.
Those of you who haven't done it, go look up William Shatner SNL. And that was, you know, a great, it's a classic, you know, skit, which, anyhow. Listen, everybody.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.